Can you hear me? All right. So this is Avnish Bastil Sharma, and I have 4 questions. I know, sorry.
Present a
slideshow. Right, so I have 4 questions. First of all, aren't we losing Lawrence Inferiance doing Lattice QCD?
Yes.
And are you worried about it, or?
So it's restored, of course, in the continuum limit. Mm-hmm. Gauge symmetry also. So it you have O4, no, you have a hypercubic invariance. So it's a discrete subgroup of the O4 group. So with this discrete subgroup and the fact that we have preserved exact gauge invariance in our discretization by using parallel transport, this guarantees that in the continuum limit, the only operator you can write is G squared, essentially. So there is a well-defined continuum limit, and it is QCD. Of course, away from the continuum limit, you have what you call lattice artifacts, which are due to the fact that you have a reduced symmetry group. So for a symmetry such as supersymmetry is much more difficult. Okay, so there you really have to play all sorts of tricks in order to obtain the continuum limit. But we're fortunate, at least gauge invariance is strong enough that you restore the correct theory in the continuum limit.
All right, thank you. So the second one is, so is there a minus sign problem when we run calculations on the lattice and also do Monte Carlos?
Okay, so that's a good question too. No, there isn't, unless you try to do finite density. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the point is, you can show their theorems which show that the Green's function in Euclidean space-time contain all of the same information as the ones in Minkowski space-time. So we work in the Euclidean, and in the Euclidean everything is real, essentially. So you don't have this problem. The problem reemerges if you try to put in a chemical potential. Then you do have a sign problem, and we don't know how to solve it.
Okay. So, out of curiosity, what kind of boundary conditions do we use for the lattice?
Okay, so the boundary conditions that I've been using are for the fermions, periodic in space, antiperiodic in time, mm-hmm. and for the gauge fields, the periodic all over. But there are other possibilities, but yeah. These are sort of the standard ones.
Okay, and then the last one. So, in QFT, in the path integral approach, we usually normalize out the disconnected vacuum graphs. Now, why do we still need them in lattice calculations?
Okay, so when I call, so you're probably talking about
this
graph, the disconnected?
Yeah, so the disconnected vacuum
graph. So it's only disconnected. Well, I should have said quark disconnected. So the quark lines are not present, but these two quark loops are filled in with gluons. So there's no fully disconnected diagram.
Oh, okay.
So when I say disconnected, I should have been more precise. It's really quark disconnected.
All right, that's it. Thank you.
You asked me to ask you again the question that I asked this morning. So it was, at some point you mentioned that you kind of select configurations randomly and you try to evaluate their contribution in the path integral. So how do you ensure like ergodicity, and what if there are some configurations that play a major role in the path integral, and how can you manage with this?
Okay, so we discussed this over coffee break, and I suggested that you raise it again because it's an important question, mostly for moving forward. So the answer is in the simulations. So one has the sort of loss of ergodicity, which you're mentioning, as you approach the continuum limit, because the topological sectors in the theory become more and more disconnected. The sort of action potential between two different topological sectors essentially grows as you go to the continuum limit. So there we definitely lose ergodicity. So in the simulations I showed, we sort of push things as far as you could in terms of fineness of lattice spacing and still have regular transitions between different topological sectors. Okay, and so what we generate what we call trajectories. So it's a Markov chain, and then you do a Monte Carlo accept reject on this at the end. And so on our finer lattices, we find that we need about 40 trajectories before we can actually, before topology changes. So we actually run longer in order to make sure that we have a good sort of topological susceptibility in the theory. So now if you go to finer lattice spacings, and this is the challenge that we're now facing, so to gain in precision, we're going to have to go to much, or to finer lattice spacing. And there, we've started pushing, and we see the essentially what we call the autocorrelation time, or the time before it takes before you start changing topological sector. This starts blowing up really, really quickly, and to the extent that it's going to be difficult to push things further. So then we're going to need new ideas in order to push things further. So there are a number of ways of doing this. I mentioned open boundary conditions this morning. So this is one way that's been already implemented. And what this allows, it allows topology to flow in through the boundary and flow out. So you can change topological sectors. And that way, it has other problems because you start feeling these boundaries quite far away, so you have to have sort of bigger volumes in order to be able to work sort of in the central region. And then you can imagine all sorts of algorithmic types of improvement. So I don't know how much I should say about this, but people are trying some machine learning on this. As I told you, one could imagine doing sort of two simulations in two steps. So so what happens is on coarse lattices, this potential between topological sectors falls. So you sample well topological sectors, but then you're far from the continuum limit. So you could imagine working at very fine lattices. You would be stuck in a topological sector. You could even choose the topological sector you're stuck in. And then what the problem is, you know, how do you sum up the contributions from the different topological sectors? And as I told you, one way of doing it would be to somehow compute the weight of each topological sector on a finer lattice and then translate this and sum up with these weights and on the finer lattices. So there are many tricks. There are also room for good ideas. So if you have good ideas on these sorts of subjects, it would be very useful.
Yeah, this is Bernd. So for this AMU, you said that because it's like a long-range thing, you're affected both by the, the AA going zero limit and the finite volume of the L to infinity. So I wonder if there's approaches to kind of have a mixed grid instead of a regular grid of like partially fine, partially coarse, maybe in like a wavelet transform style or tensor network style. But yeah, trying to think about it, maybe this does not make sense, but yeah, just curious. Yeah.
No, so all good ideas. So a lot of these things were tried actually when Chris was on the lattice, a lot more things. So this was sort of, you were around when lattice field theory began. And so at that time, many different things were tried, random lattices, you know, in order to restore, for example, O4 invariance, you could imagine that you have random lattices, and sort of on average, you would have O4 invariance. There are other possibilities. You can use different, not hypercubic, but other shapes. Nobody has really tried anything like a wavelet transform. So what you have to be able to do is implement such a discretization. The important thing is you have to be able to do it while maintaining gauge invariance. So I don't know of any technique. So what I was suggesting is actually doing, you know, two different simulations, fine and coarse, and somehow combining them. And this could answer some of these questions. What we also do is you can separate the calculation. So what we did here was we actually performed the calculation in relatively large volumes and fine volumes, so we could fine lattice spacing, so we controlled the continuum limit. And then as an ulterior step, we computed the finite size effects by working on a rather coarse lattice, but very big volume. So you can play these sorts of tricks, breaking up the calculation in pieces. But finding a formulation that does everything at once, I don't really know of that.
May I ask a question?
No. Yes, please.
Doctor, please.
Yes, professor.
This morning there was a question by Gerard about approximating SU3 or any group that you use. Mm-hmm. Now, in the old times, we used, my God, this was in 78 or 79, I used the icosahedral group as an approximation to SU2. And then your criticism would have been asymptotic freedom is out of the window, right? That mm-hmm. is what you said this morning.
Yeah.
Now, in what sense is your way of handling SU3 really... It's also an approximation to SU3,
no,
right?
No. It's fully SU3. It's fully SU3. So we maintain full SU3 gauge uh-huh. invariance on the finite lattice through these link variables. So it's really fully.
Well, okay, yeah, but your method of doing it on the lattice, on simulating, you pick elements, right?
Yeah. So there's some random Markov chain.
Yeah, but does that not somehow? It's in what sense is that really the continuous? Well,
okay. Well, we don't pick the discrete. I mean, so what we do is we solve, part of the algorithm is this molecular dynamic simulation where you go through field space, essentially through molecular dynamics, and the shifts in the fields are essentially continuous. I mean, there's no discretization of the group.
We had at the time the semantic improved action. And one could think of doing something similar. This is discrete cage groups, so that you add more than one action, and you adjust the parameters such as you get asymptotically free behavior.
Yeah,
is that possible?
Yeah. So this is actually incorporated. So our gauge action is a Luscher-Weiss gauge action. So it has also two plaquette contributions, which eliminate the leading A squared discretization errors. So this sort of thing is incorporated in most calculations now in a more or less standard way. So you can either tune these parameters. So ideally you would tune these parameters non-perturbatively so that you would eliminate discretization errors, not say only A squared, but alpha S A squared to all orders. But already just eliminating them at tree level on finite lattices makes a difference and improves the approach to the continuum limit.
Okay. Me? Okay. So could you comment on your disagreement with the R ratio? What is it? 2 sigma, you said?
So 2 sigma on the total mu, but 3.7 sigma on this window quantity. Mm. So this is this limited, so it's about a third. Let me see, where do I discuss this? So it's this quantity here. So we compute this, so this is about a third of the a little less than a third of the contribution of light quarks to the total mu. And as you can see here, this is our result, this is the R ratio result. So one thing which is interesting is because this quantity is sort of optimized for lattice calculation, it's not too short range, it's not too long range, we can easily get even smaller errors than the R ratio. So here we were very conservative. We could easily cut this error in half and make it a 5 sigma probably effect. So this is a big effect. Which has to be understood. So we started discussing this a bit yesterday. So one can continue these sorts of comparisons, so break things up into windows on the lattice in time and compare to the R ratio and try to see in what distant regions on the lattice do we differ more from the R ratio. So this would be able to tell us, well, maybe we're making a mistake at these intermediate distances or not, and things are, we're in more agreement in this region. So this sort of can point to sectors where we have problems. The issue here, though, this is a place where we should have no problems. So the weight sort of shifts towards the R ratio, at least in this particular region. And in order to understand what happens in the R ratio, so as I stated yesterday, what we compute on the lattice is actually a Laplace transform of this complicated spectrum. So we get this smooth function, correlation function as a function of t, and it's just a Laplace transform of the spectrum. So in order to go from our calculation to the spectrum, you have to invert this Laplace transform. And we have systematic errors, statistical errors, and we also don't have continuous curves. So you're trying to get a continuous amount of information from finite data. So it's clear that we cannot reconstruct it's an ill-defined mathematical problem. So we can't reconstruct the whole spectrum. So what I'm looking into is being a lot more modest and trying to determine whether there are particular regions in the spectrum, say perhaps a 2π contribution, so which covers quite a range in the spectrum. There we may have enough information on the lattice to say, well, maybe the 2π is incorrect, but the 3π region is correct, and this sort of thing. So sort of more global statements about the R ratio. Then I guess the other answer to the question is who's right and who's wrong. So for the moment, we don't know. If you were to put your money on something, they've been doing these dispersive calculations and measuring E plus E minus for decades. This is sort of the first time a lattice calculation sort of reaches the same precision. So you could say, our calculations are too young, there's something we forgot. So this is one possibility. Another possibility, as I showed you yesterday, is that there's a problem with the data. So as you probably know, Chloe and Babar don't fully agree. So is one right and the other one wrong? One could maybe try to determine this. And then there's a sort of third possibility is that there's new physics in E plus E minus to hadrons of the type we discussed yesterday, so sort of with a dark photon. And then there's even a fourth possibility, is that Babar and Chloe function at different energies. Okay, Chloe is of course a phi factory, and Babar is a B factory or an upsilon factory. And therefore one could imagine that the difference between the two cross sections or R ratios is due to some difference, new physics, which contributes only to one and not to the other. So there are many possibilities right now, and I think first the lattice has to be really solidified and confirmed, but then you have to also explore all these different possibilities.
This is not a physics question, but in the machine learning community, I think the trend is to go towards dedicated hardware like tensor processing units and so on. Is this also a thing in Lattice, or do you use more general purpose CPUs or GPUs?
Okay, so that's a good question, and it's sort of a painful question for us, because every time an architecture changes, we have to completely rewrite our codes, and they're highly optimized codes. So, some parts on certain machines, not on all machines, are written in assembly to go faster. So, and the way you organize the calculation memory, the way you store, gauge fields, et cetera, is very different from architecture to architecture. So the ideal machine for us is a machine which is extremely balanced between not very fast CPUs and very fast communications, because where this is usually a rate limiting step. So, and on machines that have very fast processors and slow communications, most of the time is spent waiting for data to come from a neighboring. So you divide the lattice and sublattices, and then you have to exchange boundary terms, and you waste a lot of time like this. So in order to take advantage of new architectures, like all these GPU architectures with very fast processors, they have pretty fast memory, so this is pretty good. Sometimes you lose a lot in communication between nodes. So sometimes you have to think of the calculation in a completely different way. So organize things in a different way. It becomes cheaper to recalculate than to transfer memory. So you can imagine, you know, not storing the full SU3 matrix and transferring it, but, you know, only transferring enough information that you can reconstruct it as you transfer it. So there are all sorts of tricks that can be played. The difficulty is that we're mostly physicists. All these optimizations take huge amount of time, so we have a huge deficit in manpower in order to follow all the technological evolutions. So here too, I think, you know, people with a strong computer science background and a strong interest in physics too can contribute a lot, because you know, factors of 4 or 5 in the code means that you can do this project in 1 year instead of 5 or 10 years. It makes all the difference. So
did anybody try to make an exercise to calculate this parameter here in
Oh, sorry, I was looking. Yeah.
With R ratio from Chloe only and from Babar only, to see what is the difference between the two results?
Yes, so this I showed you a bit, so not the full AMU. I don't have the, I have the numbers somewhere else. I don't have a slide with this right here. But so this is each data set individually on this limited range, and this is sort of, as far as I understand, a maximal deviation range.
So if you take Babar, will more or less fall on your calculation?
In this region, so you see there are about 10 units more in Babar than Chloe, but the final result is somewhere in between. So there are 5, and we need 14 units, so I don't think Babar is quite enough. But it certainly goes in the right direction.
That means to me that the systematics of this data is comparable of the data. The systematics induced by the data looks to be comparable with the difference between.
It's not. I don't know if you know Michel Davier. This group, they did the Babar analysis, and when they combined the results yesterday, what I said is they for the total AMU, they do the calculation without Chloe, without Babar. The other numbers actually don't influence so much because they have much larger errors, and they find a difference, I think, of about 6 units. So this one is more, and this is more because there's a certain region where they disagree more, and then they, you know, Babar is higher than Chloe in this region, and then they cross over a bit. So they do take this into account in the total AMU R ratio in this calculation too. So we actually did, we computed the R ratio too, and we blew up the error to try to take into account a Babar-Chloe type difference. We didn't do it perfectly, but so in principle, this does include at least some of this systematic.
Thanks.
Yes. No, as you said, there has been a lot of effort to try to investigate the possibility that in plus and minus into Hadrons there are some unknown particles, so essentially the cross-section which is quoted does not correspond to the full cross-section. However, you know, putting some new particles in this cross-section, you run into the problem of having alpha then running in a way which is not compatible with the usual running, meaning that for the precision, electroweak precision tests, for instance, you can have problems. So a possibility could be to have particles which do not enter the running of alpha, and this is a possibility. Another possibility that was recently pointed out is that we could have made a mistake in measuring the luminosity in plus and minus, because some new physics enters, if you want, in the bubble in measurement of luminosity. So I was wondering if you have some thoughts about these different routes which have been taken, trying to accommodate your result with the R ratio result.
Okay, so this, of course, is a great question. There's one possibility you didn't mention, is that there's strange hadrons that we're producing, and that they're long-lived and they fly out of the detector.
Yes.
In this energy region, and we just don't see them. So this is mostly inclusive at low energy. So you're looking for pions, you're looking for kaons, you're looking for eta primes, all sorts of things with photons. But if there's some exotic hadron which for some reason is long-lived or decays into particles we're not really looking for, then one could have a problem. So there's this possibility. On the other possibilities, I would think I'm sort of agnostic about the new physics possibilities there. Another possibility is that radiative corrections are an issue here. You're using this radiative return method, so you have to make sure that you really count the photons correctly, that you're already one order down in alpha after radiative return. So in order to control your experiment, you need the Monte Carlos, which are accurate to one additional order, et cetera. Mm-hmm. All of these things are tested against the data, but it's clearly a complicated thing to do. So, but for new physics, I tend to favor, I think everybody does, something which doesn't only explain E plus E minus into hadrons in the G minus 2 region, so not something sort of tuned for G minus 2, but which may explain other phenomena. So, you know, maybe if you have a candidate for dark matter or something like this, which may be difficult in this mass range, but a new physics mechanism which actually sort of explains a number of discrepancies. Do you have a favorite one?
Yes, well, in our case, we tried, you know, to modify the plus and minus cross-section, but without modifying the alpha, so the hadronic vacuum polarization, which might be a possibility, in fact.
And so how do you do this?
Sorry?
How do you do this?
Well, you can do with a particle which does not couple directly for the running of alpha. The point is that in this case the particle really subtracts to the total cross-section. Mm-hmm. So This might be possible, for instance, with a light vector boson, mm-hmm. like Z prime or some kind of dark photon might present some problems because of the mixing with the photon. So again, okay. You might have, but some light vector boson could accommodate things. Obviously, you have to constrain the parameters in order to construct a model which fits exactly the data.
And is it a chiral?
Sorry?
Is it a chiral gauge boson?
Unfortunately, we have to...
Yeah, you can make...
Unfortunately, we have to terminate the discussion here.
Okay, we can continue later.
So I guess you can continue privately. I'd like to thank the speaker.
Did you set for 20 minutes? Right?
No, 25 minutes. Okay, then now we have the...